Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to have a very different type of a program. Normally, I will sit down with a scientist of some description and talk about astronomy or physics, microbiology, who knows what. Today, we're going to be talking to a director of a museum. This particular person is Daniel Corey Whalen. He is the director of the Centennial Museum here at UT El Paso. And you might say, well, Keith, why are you doing this? Well, because there's a particular exhibit that's just starting in El Paso at the Centennial Museum. It's called The Town and the Smelter. So the people in town must be already saying, it's all about ASARCO, the big copper smelter down in the west. And you'd be correct, because it's an important location. Copper is a fundamental chemical element needed in all sorts of industrial processes, conducts electricity, you've got it in your houses. But where does it come from? Well, it comes from ores in the ground. They have to be smelted to get crude copper and then electro-refined. And ASARCO facility in El Paso, Texas, for over 100 years, was one of the major suppliers of raw copper for refineries. Absolutely important economically, technologically. We're having this exhibition at the Centennial Museum, and our guest is the director of that museum. And so, finally, welcome to Science Studio, Daniel.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into what it is that this exhibit is all about and what you're concentrating on and what message you want to send to the area, how on earth did you become a director of a museum?
Great question. I think hopefully it's years of experience in education. That's how I became, I think, a director. So I, as you said, I'm not a scientist. I'm a humanist. So I have two master's degrees in American Studies and Urban Planning from the University of Kansas. And my bachelor's degree is from the University of Missouri, Kansas City, in history. So history has kind of been the core of my educational experience. And then once I started working in museums, the first job I had was at the Kansas State Historical Society. So I've usually worked for historical or humanities institutions in the past.
When did you know? Because usually I'll ask a scientist that question, and they'll say, when I was five or six, I went outside and looked at the sky, and it was, if he was lucky or she was lucky, the Milky Way was there, or they got interested in kicking rocks. How did you become enamored with this as an area of study? Can you remember 5, 6, 10, 15?
Yeah, I think that, you know, most of us in the museum profession go back to a story in our lives, and so I think we all have these little narratives, and so I definitely have one of those. But yet that,
well, what is it? Tell us.
Okay, yeah. So I think that, and it actually was a natural history museum. So when I was a child, I don't know how old I was, we took a field trip from the Kansas City area where I grew up. We went up to the University of Kansas to the Natural History Museum there.
That's Manhattan?
It is in Lawrence, Kansas.
Oh, Lawrence.
Yeah, K-State's our rival. So,
But
we went up there, and they had, for a long time before the epidemic that killed bees, they had an amazing, the colony crash killed this bee colony that was in the museum, but they had this amazing exhibit where they had the colony was inside, the hive was inside, and they had this little tube that went to the outside, and you could see all the bees going in and out and going into the hive and seeing into the hive. And I was probably 9 or 10 or so, but it definitely stuck with me. And that idea of, you know, learning outside the classroom, of being in a museum, the field trip, right?
Okay.
That we often remember as children. Those are very impressionable moments in children's lives. And it's unfortunate that a lot of schools now don't take enough field trips. We feel, especially in the museum field, that they're not taking enough field trips. They're all in classrooms teaching to the test. So got to have more of that.
And perhaps also worrying about culpability if something goes wrong.
Sure,
the insurance and all of the legal restrictions on freedom of educational experiences, in a sense.
Yeah, very much so.
So you saw the bees, and rather than saying, gosh, I want to learn about animal studies, or I want to do enzymology or entomology or whatever other ology, museum was the point that stuck with you. Here you were getting that experience,
yes.
And it was the bigger picture of the experience, not
yes.
the actual experience.
Content.
Right.
Yeah, right. Very much so. And I think, you know, when I went to graduate school at the University of Kansas, I had thought I wanted to be a college professor. And so I went in to get my master's in American studies and had thought that I was going to go on that path. And you know, for those of our audience who've been out there, who've been to graduate school, that first semester is pretty rough. And I realized that I don't know if I want to be a college professor. And that's actually how I kind of ended up in urban planning. I started looking into that field, and there's a double master's of American studies in urban planning. But also that first semester, I had tried to get a graduate teaching assistant, which everyone wants to do when they're a first semester graduate student. But I didn't get one. And instead, I worked for the Special Collections on campus, the Spencer Archives, I believe is what it's called at the University of Kansas. And there I was introduced. That's when I found my calling, is the introduction to kind of cultural resources, that there's education that happens outside of the classroom in museums and archives and other places. And that's kind of where I started latching onto that.
Learning outside of the formal classroom.
Yes.
I mean, is I think most of our education comes that way.
Right.
In fact,
yes.
Not all professors are riveting.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, quite often you're thrown back to your own devices. I mean, it's still formal education. You've got textbooks and the like. But the museum can be absolutely stimulating.
Yes.
Now, so when did you come to the Centennial Museum?
So I've been the director of the Centennial Museum for 2 years. So at the University of Kansas, I met my wife, Ofra Lizer Whalen. She is a tenured professor here in the sociology department. So she moved us here 7 years ago.
All right. And then you had to wait 5 years to get the job that you really wanted.
Exactly.
Okay, lovely. Now, so here you are. You've now got a position. You're the director. Who makes the decisions as to what on earth you do?
So we do have a faculty advisory board that does help us make some decisions, but for the most part, they are internal. So I'm, as a president once famously said, I'm the decider.
Well, this is wonderful. So you decided then to... So you were never here when the Osaka was actually functioning.
Not when it was functioning. We moved here, and I think within the first year we saw the smokestacks come down. Yes.
Right. And did you watch?
I did watch.
Right.
Yes, I could see it from. I live in the Mission Hills neighborhood here,
okay,
and
right.
I could see it from my porch. So.
Well, we all went up to John McClure's place on Piedmont.
Sure.
And
yeah.
And had drinks and watched it come down, and it was an interesting. I was one of the people that thought it should stay up.
Yes.
I thought that America is very good at raising history.
Yes.
Right? And
yeah.
As long as it was safe, but it was going to cost a lot of money. But I think somebody suggested it should look like a pencil with an eraser on the top.
Right.
Or something.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's cute.
Yeah,
you know, a piece
yeah.
of artwork.
Yes.
But that wasn't what happened.
I too was, even though I'd only lived here for a short time, it had already become a landmark for myself and my family. I wanted to see it stay. But also, there's a deeper thing, and I've been telling people about this exhibit, that as a historian, as a historic preservationist, I think, unfortunately, we're destroying our working class landscape. We're destroying all the industry, all that industry that was down there, the Globe Mills, the silos, the Jesus Live silos, I
yeah,
call
right.
them. They're all destroyed, and we're a working class town, and that's what a lot of this exhibit talks about, and we're destroying
right.
our infrastructure.
And I go one stage further, in the sense that it when that Asarco, it wasn't called Asarco right at the beginning, but it became Asarco when they all got together, the various copper smelting companies. It's a piece of technological history.
Yes.
It's not trivial to take ores, just things you can dig up, with a very, very small amount of copper. That was the key feature to this place, that they could take low-grade ores and smelt it, and then come out with copper in bulk that can be utilized later for refining into copper wire, et cetera.
Yes.
That isn't trivial.
No.
And this particular facility was ahead of its time. I think
very
it was the most efficient in the world while it was going at those low-grade ores. It's gone, and it's going. And I don't mind that because times change. But some recognition of what was there and some exhibit to illustrate the technology I would have liked. But tell us how you go about then putting something on about the smelter and the town.
Right. So I think that when I first, before I took this job here, I was teaching museum studies. So the university hired me on as a lecturer in the art department, because that's where museum studies is housed. So I was teaching students museum studies.
In the Department of Art?
In the Department of Art, yes.
Okay.
And I think it was housed there because it really kind of grew up out of the Rubin Center. That was kind of the main point of contact for a lot of the students. Then, of course, when I was there, the humanities background, we started branching out and worked more with the Centennial. And I had a student who had an internship at the Special Collections here. And that student, Michael Reyes, who we later hired on to actually curate the smelter side of the exhibit, he curated a small exhibit in the Special Collections on the third floor. They often have exhibits. And it was right after... So the Asarco gave a lot of its documents, I think most of its documents, to the University of Texas at El Paso. It's in our special collections. And so he started going through that and created a little exhibit. And this is when the reclamation was going on. Mr. Puga had come to that opening. I met him then. But it just, you know, I thought one day we need to have a larger exhibit. And so I kept in touch with my student. He went off to San Francisco and got his master's degree in museum studies. And he came back and we kind of nabbed him to create this exhibit. But also there was two books that came out last year, Copper Stain, Asarco's Legacy in El Paso, and then also The Women of Smelter Town. And they both came out last year and kind of inspired us. Hey, we need to do an exhibit about this.
Okay, so we've set it all up. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Daniel Corey Whalen, who is the director of the Centennial Museum, to talk about the content and the significance of the exhibit, The Town and the Smelter, in the Centennial Museum. We'll be back in 1 minute. Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Daniel Corey Whalen, who is the director of the Centennial Museum. And we set up in the first half the background about Daniel, about the exhibit. Tell us what the real thrust of the exhibit is, because there's many ways to go.
Right. Yeah, there are many ways to go. And I think in part, being a humanities person, that it was really about the people, right? That we started meeting the people who lived in Smelter Town. We started meeting the workers who worked at Asarco. So it's really about the people that that were a part of this, that is the thrust of the exhibit.
So the technological part, the scientific part, if I can use that word,
yes,
is really not relevant to you, other than you've got to know that it was important and
right,
a major contribution not only to the city, but also to the technology of the United States.
Yes, I think that a lot of it is more maybe implied in the science is more implied than direct. The stories we are telling are of the process. We actually utilized the ASARCO had kind of this dog and pony show where they had six panels that they would take around and describe the process. And we had worked with a scientific advisor to try to talk about that process and realized, well, we're not going to be able to do a better job than these panels. And this is what ASARCO talked about.
I hasten to say one of the panels was not me. But I mean, I went through the exhibit with you yesterday,
yes.
And I mean, there are some terms in there that I'd be hard-pressed to explain to anybody.
Yes, yeah. And I guess some of them are kind of the Con-Top furnace was one of them.
Right, yes.
You know, that there were a lot of technical terms, but I think one of the things that, like you said, the technology was always changing, and I was rereading last night Elaine Hampton and Cynthia Ontiveros' Copper Stain, and in it they're saying this is how it was done when we wrote the book or when we were interviewing these people who worked there. So that was mainly in the late 90s. So the smelter closes down in 99. But they say go to ASARCO.com if you want to see how they're doing it today. So even in the last 20 years— new technologies,
oh, absolutely.
new ways of doing things. So you're really only getting, in the exhibit, you're only getting a snapshot. How it was done in probably the 80s and 90s, it was done differently in the decades before and since.
I'd like to sort of dwell on that point, because the title of the book is Copper Stain, which is already derogatory in a sense. Stain, STAIN. The implication is that there's something rather unpleasant about it, that it's left a residue in the area. And there's absolutely no doubt that the technology, when it started over 100 years ago, was primitive, but still state of the art.
Yes.
It was as good as was known anywhere in the world, and probably better. And so it kept improving in the sense of the technology more efficient, but also with a bigger understanding that, wait a minute, there are people that are beginning to move in close to the smelter.
Right.
When it started, there was nobody living around except, and we'll come on to that in a minute, the people who worked for the company.
Yeah.
But then when sort of the middle class people started to move closer, it was clear that this was going to have an impact and maybe we should clean up the act, if I can say that. And they introduced all sorts of new technologies themselves.
Yes.
And I think it's always a little tough to look backwards and say, oh, what a terrible situation it was. And the ASARCO, you know, it was almost a swear word.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
And that's not fair.
Yeah. I think that I would contest that a little bit in that ASARCO, the more we dug into it, they never relented. They never were culpable, right? They always said, every time when the lead stuff came out in the 1970s,
right.
So some of the science I think that's implied is kind of the toxicology side of things, right? And we're doing some programming, and we're going to get university professors here to kind of talk about the science aspects through programming, but that they're, you know, when the lead stuff came out in the 70s, because they also did lead. So copper was the end, but the lead stacks were going, and everyone was pointing to ASARCO, and ASARCO said, no, it's the cars. You know, back then we had lead in our fuel, right? And that probably didn't help, but just, you know, never taking responsibility.
It's very familiar in the sense of people who recall back the smoking business.
Right.
You know, Philip Morris, oh, it was nothing to do with smoking that caused lung cancer.
Yeah.
I mean, there is a reflex
that
says, no, I'm not culpable here. But my real point, I guess, there is the fact that technology changes, and you said that.
Yes.
And it got better and better and better.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the technology, there were kind of two technological advances. It was in the smelting process, and that, of course, was, I think, ASARCO was very interested in, right? I mean, that was improving their processes and moving it forward. But then there was the emission side of things, and I think that moved slower, and it wasn't until the national, the EPA and all OSHA and all these things, the national laws kind of, you know, forced it to be that way. And it's my understanding that ASARCO is currently, you know, 20 years after we've closed this, they're moving even further to make it cleaner. And so,
you mean the site or
the?
I mean, does ASARCO still exist?
They still exist. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Right.
So they have smelters scattered around the world?
Yes. So they have smelters around the world, and they're still in Arizona.
Oh, okay.
And it's my understanding that they are working hard to, you know, reduce those emissions.
Accepting a lot of your premises there. I remember when I came here in the early 70s, I could taste the sulfur dioxide, but being a chemist, I'd sort of been used to it, which is bad for me. I'm sure it is. But there was also the feature that during the day, you wouldn't get too much pollution or you couldn't see it. But boy, at nighttime, you'd really, living close in Kern where I live, you could see it. And so there was this business of turning it on and off as a visual optic.
Yes.
So, I mean, that. Well, I buy that.
And also which way the wind blew.
Oh, yeah,
so
absolutely.
When the wind was blowing towards Mexico, they were turning it up.
Tell us a little bit about the actual exhibit. What's a highlight for you?
For me, I think it's the personal stories. It really is. Of the people working there and the people who used to live there. We have... So the other book that I mentioned, The Women of Smelter Town, was a UTEP professor, Mimi Gladstein, and Marcia Dottestel was her co-writer, and Carol Eastman's photos were in that book. And they found these people who used to live in Smelter Town, right around the smelter. But a lot of those people moved out. When you kind of made it, you were able to earn enough money to move out of Smelter Town. You went to a little, many people moved to a place called Buena Vista, and it's still there. It's kind of behind Rosa's Cantina for all the local listeners.
And in fact, Rosa's Cantina was an outcrop of these people migrating from Smelter Town to Buena Vista.
Right. Very
so and it, so. It's not that old, actually.
Yeah. And so, it's not as the song says it, right? But so just telling the stories of the people who lived there and their memories, because a lot of people who lived in Smelter Town didn't want to see it destroyed. It was destroyed in the early 70s. It was vacated in 72, and it was because of the lead pollution. But they didn't want to leave because there was community. It was the community and the camaraderie, the story of these men. These men still meet once a month, the people who work there at First Cafeteria over on the east side and reminisce about the olden days, you know? So it's this community
it reminds me of novels like Germinal and the whole business of coal mining and coal mining communities.
Right.
I mean, they go down under the ground every day and they come up, but they're a tight-knit group of people.
Yeah.
And proud of their environment.
Yes, very much so.
So, in fact, I think I read somewhere, or maybe I saw it yesterday, they had a bowling alley in ASARCO.
Yeah.
And they had their own team.
There's a wonderful picture of them holding a bunch of men holding bowling trophies and softball teams. And ASARCO gave back to the community. They donated money to organizations. Similar to UTEP, how we have the annual campaign and. So people remember donating to kind of a United Way. I'm not sure exactly how it worked, but they donated to together as ASARCO employees back to the community.
And a lot of the employees, as I saw at the exhibit yesterday, were Mexican nationals, right? And in fact, it was some nice little exhibit you had about how the Americanization especially the ladies, in terms of the food that they would cook and the names that they would give them, it would start out as Mexican food like dulce de arroz or something, and then it would become meatloaf. It was just an interesting transition there in that one little aspect.
Yeah, very much so. I think that we have a little interactive and we're encouraging people to write recipes down and talk about memories of the holidays. A lot of the women ran little kitchens out of their kind of impromptu lunch counters because the men would, especially if, you know, they're living in Smeltertown, they it was very close. They could walk back on their lunch break and they could get food from one of the local women.
Okay, we're running out of time. I just wanted two things about the name, Asarco, that I saw yesterday.
I like it. We heard this from one of the gentlemen who worked there, and it's Sons and Relatives Company.
All Sons and Relatives Company.
There we go. Right. Yeah,
I thought that was very good. And it goes to the concept of the community.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. And intergenerational, it's really interesting. I really enjoy talking to a lot of the men who work there now so that their fathers and their grandfathers work there, right?
But does anybody work there now?
But then their son, well, the ones that they were working there till 99, right?
Right.
And so they, their parents and grandparents worked there, but then their sons did not, right? That's when they made sure those men were making enough money to make sure their kids went to college. And I've met some of them of that generation. They're kind of my age in their 40s or so. And they're now doctors and lawyers. They really have achieved the American dream, right?
Would be a very interesting article or book by itself.
Yes.
Grandchildren of the Asarco Working Group. And see the success stories.
Yeah, very much so.
Well, it's been a successful 28 minutes, Daniel. We've run out of time.
Wow, it's been great.
We should do another one, in fact, you know, to talk a little bit about the technology, the science behind smelting and refining, but that's not what this exhibit's all about.
Well, we'll get some programs about that.
Good stuff. So we've been listening to a little conversation with Daniel Carey Whalen, director of the Centennial Museum, all about an exhibit called The Town and the Smelter. It's on until the middle of January of 2020. So make sure you spend some time there. Learn about Asarco, the history, the people. And I think you'll have a very good afternoon or morning. Yep. They open at 10 o'clock. I just add that because I didn't know that yesterday when I turned up at 9.
10 to 4:30, yes.
So I'd like to thank Sam Cassiano for putting this whole thing together. And Daniel, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Keith. We appreciate it.
And we'll be back next week with a little more science, I gather, but it'll be fun. Bye-bye.